Today is October 17, and we're having Professor Morandi with us to talk about what's going on right now in the Middle East. Welcome back, Professor.
Thank you very much for having me.
And let's get started. We know that recently you were in Turkey talking about the situation in Gaza. What do we know about the public opinion in Turkey right now?
From my understanding, the general public is very supportive of the people in both Palestine and Lebanon, and that there's a lot of support for the resistance in Lebanon, which has begun a major battle or has begun serious fighting with the Israeli regime on the borderline. But the government continues to play a very ambivalent role. The rhetoric is very pro-Palestine, but in reality, they continue to allow oil from Baku and Central Asia to go to Israel, cheap oil, and trade continues to flow back and forth between Turkey and the Israeli regime through differing mechanisms. From my understanding, there's a lot of discontent, even among supporters and members of the ruling party, with regards to the policy being pursued by the government. But in general, as I said earlier on, the mood is very pro-Palestinian, in fact, and pro-Hezbollah. In fact, there was a demonstration. There are two demonstrations in Istanbul and in Ankara that were taking place during my stay there, and both of them were crushed by the police. I don't really want to go into great detail about Turkey because my information is anecdotal and it comes from my Turkish friends who live in Istanbul, who teach at universities, and they have their own circles. So it may not reflect, everything may not be completely accurate, but that is my understanding from the information that I get from my colleagues and counterparts and friends in Turkey.
And what's so important right now is how Iran and Turkey are willing to work with each other in order to put an end to the conflict in Gaza, which is so important for the people who are living there, who are under attack from Israelis. And do you think that we had the same kind of mindset in the Soviet Union, China, right now? Nobody would have ever thought that Russia and China getting together the way they are right now. They are getting together. They are getting better, improvement. And a lot of improvements, a lot of in their foreign policy, in their military policy. And we had the same thing between China and India. They're getting along with each other. When we're going to have that watershed moment between Iran and Turkey, which we know is so important for people of Gaza, for Palestinians?
Well, Turkey is in a very complicated situation. On the one hand, it is a part of NATO. And on the other hand, it is seeing the world tilt away from NATO. So we do see a growing interest in BRICS, which leadership in Turkey has expressed. But at the same time, we don't see a determination or the will for the Turkey to leave NATO and the Western Bloc. It's not just an issue of different political parties. I think the political establishment in Turkey still tilts towards the West, and that is the, I think, key reason why Iran and Turkey are not able to go a great deal further together in defense of the Palestinian people than what they're doing now. Turkey and Iran, politically, they're cooperating with regards to media and public opinion. I think both countries are, in general, supporting the Palestinian people. I don't know about the all of the media in Turkey, but from what I understand, the general the pro-government media, at least, is supportive of the Palestinian people. I would imagine that the same is true with other parties as well under these circumstances. But again, the problem is the EU, it is NATO. The EU is never going to allow Turkey to join. I think that's obvious to everyone. And I personally don't think the EU has much of a future. Challenges that the European Union are facing today and the challenges that NATO is facing today, I think that make it questionable whether they will last in the long term. But in any case, Turkey is where it is right now.
Yeah. Recently, we've learned that the foreign minister of Iran was talking about that they're not having any sort of indirect talks with Washington, and which was so crucial in managing this situation so far. Why do we know why did the Pezeshkian administration decide not to have any sort of talk anymore with the United States?
I think the main reason is that the United States has been deceiving Iran. I don't know about many of the messages that have, or the negotiations, the indirect negotiations that have taken place. I don't know about the details, but I do know that the sort of things that the Americans have been saying to the Iranians have turned out to be very far from, very, very much detached from the reality that's taking place on the ground, or that they say or they promise to do things in order to stabilize or to decrease tensions or to bring about a ceasefire, and in reality they simply have been trying to buy time from Iran. So the Iranians have said that they're going to halt all indirect negotiations. I don't think that necessarily means that if someone brings a message from the United States that the Iranians will not speak to that person. But the indirect negotiations that took place between Iran and the United States, I think, have been halted basically because the Iranians are telling the Americans, this is not working. We no longer trust you. We never did trust you, but we now see that these indirect negotiations are simply a tool to buy time for the Israeli regime and for yourself so that they can carry out the genocide and so that you can reach election day without paying the consequences for your support for genocide. So I think it's more of a statement to the United States, a declaration to the United States and to Western countries that Iran won't be fooled or deceived by their attempts to guide events through empty promises.
And right now, with this new air defense system from Israel, from the United States to Israel, they call it the THAAD air defense system, which is a kinetic air defense system, doesn't have a warhead, cannot be used offensively. We know all of that. It's not a new air defense system. I talk with many military professionals, many military analysts, they're thinking that is not a game changer when it comes to the conflict in the Middle East. But do you think at the same time the Biden administration is trying to do something to calm down the Israeli government, the Netanyahu administration, or they're sending a message to Iran that they're going to support Netanyahu for whatever he wants to do?
I don't think they need to send a message to Iran to point out that they are supporting Netanyahu no matter what he does. But I do think It is a concession to Netanyahu, like all the other concessions that they always give to him. I don't think it's going to make a big difference. From the very beginning, when this direct conflict between Iran and the Israeli regime began, I said to people that in April, when Iran first carried out an attack, I said it back then quite openly, that the attack was mostly an intelligence gathering operation. It was basically done with a lot of old drones and mostly older missiles and a few newer missiles in order to gather intelligence, to draw fire, which the Americans and the Israelis spent, I think, together about $4 billion. But more important than the cost was for Iran to figure out what sort of capabilities they had, because they really went all out. And then after the murder of Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran and his companion when they were martyred together, I said again that, and the reason why I'm explaining this to you is because I want to, the final point that I want to make, I want people to remember what I said in the past. I said that Iran will retaliate and that the retaliation will be harsh and severe. And gradually, there was growing skepticism. And I had the final discussion I had was with Piers Morgan, where he was saying that Iran is not going to do anything. And I told him that it's coming. And it literally happened the day after. It's not because I had any inside information, but it's because I have an understanding of what goes on in Iran. And I think it's best for people in the West and elites to recognize that nothing is going to stop an Iranian retaliation if the Israeli regime strikes. The THAAD system is not going to stop it. In fact, all it is going to do is it's going to show that not only have the Israelis failed to stop Iranian missiles, but it's going to show that the Americans will fail in stopping Iranian missiles. And I think that's not going to be good for the United States when it wants to sell weapons to the rest of the world, for it to be seen as incapable. Iran will hit, regardless of what the Israeli regime does to Iran, whether they strike military targets, whether it's it goes beyond military targets, whether it's a mild attack or a very heavy attack, the Iranian response is going to be much, much harsher, much more harsh. It is not going to be the same as the Israeli attack. And so in the West, they can interpret it in whatever way they like. They will always try to spin the situation to make it seem like Israel is strong, which is fine, but at least they shouldn't make their own analysis that they give to their own leaders based upon the spin that they produce. Iran, in their strike against Israel, caused serious damage to the regime. And if it wasn't so damaging, Netanyahu wouldn't be so adamant to strike back hard at Iran. If it was a failure, then there's no reason for the Israeli regime to be so outraged. They could just say that we took out 99% of the missiles, or all the missiles fell into open fields and caused no damage, and so we don't feel the need to strike back at Iran. But they feel the need that they have to strike back hard because they were humiliated. But Iran still hasn't used its best missiles. It hasn't used its best technology. It is still using older missiles and its older capabilities because it does not want the Israelis to know what it has. And it does not want the Israelis or the Americans to be able to work on how to defend the Israeli regime against Iran's capabilities. So in April, the Americans were foolish. The Israelis were foolish. They revealed everything that they had. During the missile strike, they were unable to bring down those missiles. And today, They can talk about a THAAD system. They can talk about whatever they like. But the Iranians, if the Israeli regime strikes, Iran will hit back very hard. And then if the Israeli regime strikes again, Iran will do it again and again and again until Netanyahu is beaten into submission. And we shall see.
Yeah. And in your opinion, right now, what's going on between Israel and Lebanon, and right now between Iran and Israel, how much of what's happening right now is related to distracting people from what's going on in Gaza? Because yesterday, or the day before yesterday, they were attacking Al-Aqsa Hospital. They were burning people alive in the hospital, which it's unbelievable when you look at the pictures and you look at the videos, footages coming out of this attack. How do you find this concept, the way that the Netanyahu is trying to some sort manipulating the public opinion, the international public opinion?
Well, it's not just Netanyahu, it's the collective Western media. If you recall as well as I that a year ago, when the first hospital was bombed, they killed 500 people, according to some estimates. And there was global outrage. And then immediately, the Western media started claiming that a rocket that had failed hit the hospital. And even if a small rocket that the resistance was firing had struck the hospital, you would have had maybe a few people killed if it just hit right in the middle of them, not 500 people. It wouldn't have wiped out. So the Western media knew they were lying. But just like on October the 7th, where they lied about beheadings and about rape in order to justify the genocide in Gaza, they tried to blame the victim so that they could decrease the global rage so that the Israeli regime could continue with its genocide. What we saw a few days ago again was the same thing. They attacked the hospital. People burned alive. Were burned alive. We saw it. We saw the footage. But for example, Sky News went and tweeted about Iran and used this image as if this had nothing to do with Gaza. And also we saw how Sky News, for example, I mean the other media outlets are more or less the same, but Skype is Sky News, I think, is more crude these days in its propaganda. Sky News, when four of the Israeli soldiers were killed on the northern border with Lebanon by Hezbollah drones, soldiers that were going to be used to attack Hezbollah, Sky News read their names on and called them teenagers, as if they're just high school students who are going to school or who are coming home from school. But they never read the names of the people who were burned alive in the airstrike a few days ago. They don't read out the names of the people who are dying in the different cities in Lebanon during the airstrikes that are taking place as we speak. So Western media is trying to manage the narrative because they are part of this war. They are part of this genocide. They are guilty just like the Israeli regime. But I think that to a degree, the Israelis do want to distract attention away from Gaza. And so we won't be focused too much on the ongoing starvation siege that's taking place, where 400,000 people are being starved to death by the Israelis. And the Americans are talking about maybe punishing them a month from now after everyone is dead, probably. That is part of it. But I also think that this expansion of escalation and expansion is something that Netanyahu needs. He needs the war to continue in order to remain in power. And if he does not expand the war and it just goes on and on without any achievements, then he could also lose his hold on power as well. So he needs to attack Lebanon. He needs to strike Iranian targets in order to expand the war and to bring in the Americans. Because without the Americans, he will lose. He will lose against Hezbollah. And I said this also, this is another thing that I said earlier. I'm not an oracle. What we try to do is we just try to look at things without being influenced by Western spin. And when we do that, they call us propagandists. But the problem is that we are always right in our in the way we analyze, and they get it wrong. But they want to project what they do upon others. When Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah was martyred, when the senior commanders were martyred, Western media was saying this was a huge achievement and Hezbollah will not be able to continue and how are they going to be able to resist? And I said repeatedly in Western media that Hezbollah will emerge even stronger. And I told people that this is not rhetoric. This is not just, this is not empty. These are not empty words. Their notion that somehow Hezbollah will fall apart, or Hamas, or Islamic Jihad, or any other organization, is based upon their own Orientalist worldview, that somehow everything here is dependent on individuals, whereas in the West they have structures and they have sophisticated mechanisms and checks and balances. Here it's the same. Hezbollah is a sophisticated organization with very sophisticated and well-educated people, highly trained people, and they will continue to do their work. Just like in Iran, when Imam Khomeini passed away, in the West they were saying the revolution is over, but in a day a new leader was chosen, and we see today Iran is far more powerful and influential than it was back then. The same is true as with Hezbollah. The troops are highly motivated. The people, their morale is very high. From what I saw in Lebanon, until the very end, I can say with confidence that the people who I spoke with, their confidence grew over every day that I witnessed things. Their confidence grew from. Increase from the previous day. So Netanyahu became drunk, and so did the West, became drunk because of their successes in Beirut and the assassinations and the murders. But rational people don't get drunk. They don't make decisions, at least they don't make their key decisions when they're drunk. And right now the Israeli regime, I think, is still drunk. And their Western allies are drunk as well. Even though what we've been claiming after the martyrdom of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, that Hezbollah will beat them on the battlefield, so far has turned out to be right. The Israelis are having a very terrible time on the border between Palestine and Lebanon. Just last night, they've also had a serious defeat at the hands of Hezbollah. Of course, this war is going to possibly last a very long time, and the Israelis are going to push into Lebanon because they've massed a huge amount of huge number of forces there. But Hezbollah will actually be more lethal to the regime once they come in, because they're going to start striking from behind. Remember, Hezbollah has tunnels everywhere, and that is why they are defeating them on the border right now. But once the Israeli regime comes in, they become even more vulnerable. But in any case, from what we've seen so far, the Israelis have not had any achievements in Lebanon. And that's despite the fact that Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah is no longer among us. So I think, to put all this together, I think the West and their Israeli allies are miscalculating. They're miscalculating about Iran. And they're miscalculating about Hezbollah, just as they're miscalculating about Gaza. If they think that Netanyahu can strike Iran and that Iran will not strike back hard, they are deeply mistaken. And the Israeli regime is far more vulnerable than Iran. They say that Iran does not want a war a regional war. Of course, Iran doesn't want a regional war. No one wants a regional war except for Netanyahu. But that is not going to prevent Iran from bringing about deterrence. It's not going to change Iran's calculations on the battlefield. If the regime strikes, Iran will strike back harder. Why will it strike back harder and much harder? Because it wants to create deterrence. That's how you create deterrence. The aggressor has to regret attacking. So Iran will hit back hard, much harder. And if the regime strikes again, Iran will do it again. Does that bring about the possibility for the Americans to enter the war? It does. But it won't change Iran's calculations. Because, as I said, if Iran doesn't create deterrence, the regime will continue to carry out aggression. So the Iranians have sent messages. They've said very clearly what they're going to do. And hopefully people in the West will recognize that I mean, they can use whatever propaganda they want in the Washington Post and the New York Times and the Guardian, the Times, CNN, Fox News, and the BBC. That's fine. But in their calculations, they should be very careful not to believe their own propaganda. Their propaganda is for people, but their calculations should be based upon rational thinking and the evidence on the ground.
Yeah, when you look at the way that they went after Hezbollah by assassinations of Seyed Hassan Nasrallah together with commanders, and right now they're trying to do, went on the ground in the southern part of Lebanon, and at the same time they're trying to put a lot of pressure on the political parties in Lebanon to isolate Hezbollah politically. How do you find in that direction? Are they going to be successful? Are they going to achieve anything in Lebanon with the current phase? You've been in Lebanon recently. You know what's going on there. How do you find it in terms of the political pressure going to Hezbollah?
Well, we have to keep in mind that that's what they've been saying in Yemen. They've been trying to do the same thing in Yemen. Has it achieved results? No. Why? Because in Yemen today, Ansarullah, or the Houthis as they call them in the West, they're much more popular than ever before. Not just in Yemen, but across the world, across the region and across the world, even beyond the region. There is evidence of that. But Ansarullah inside Yemen is also more popular. No one, or very few people at least, want to be seen fighting Ansarullah as Ansarullah is fighting Israel. In Lebanon, the same is true. The Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, they're not going to move against Hezbollah because Hezbollah is fighting for them. The Sunni community in Lebanon has tilted dramatically towards Hezbollah, and they are overwhelmingly now seeing through they now see very clearly what NATO did to Syria, the schism that was created a decade ago over Syria. Now that has been healed because A, they see Hezbollah as defending Sunnis and the Palestinian cause, which the Palestinians are overwhelmingly, almost all of them are Sunni. There are some Christians, maybe a handful of Shia, but they're Sunni. And also they see that the same people who are supporting the dirty war in Syria are the ones who are killing the Palestinians today. Israel was supporting the Syrian armed groups. NATO was supporting them, and so were countries in our region that are allied to the United States. And those countries that are not today helping kill Palestinians, they're quiet. They're doing nothing. The best of them is Turkey, which just talks. Doesn't do anything in practice. So Sunnis in Lebanon have now tilted towards Hezbollah. The Christians, Iran may be despised by the West, but in our region, Christians in Syria and Iraq and Lebanon and Palestine know that Iran, Hezbollah, and their allies have always protected the Christians. So a large segment of the Christian population in Lebanon is officially, they are Hezbollah allies. They may have differences, some of them, with Hezbollah. But the only group that is really seriously trying to move towards some sort of civil war in Lebanon is the Lebanese forces and those who are close to the Lebanese forces. They don't constitute a majority. No one is going to join them against, no major group is going to join them against Hezbollah at a time when Hezbollah is fighting against this genocidal Zionist regime. So basically, anyone who joins Western embassies and the Samir Jaja and the Lebanese forces, they're going to be discredited in the eyes of the people of Lebanon, just as in Yemen, just as in Iraq or anywhere else in the region. No one wants to be seen, no sane person wants to be seen as siding with the Israeli regime, because now across the world, the regime is despised. In our region, obviously, the hatred goes even further because people are watching the news live. They see the Palestinians and the Lebanese on Arabic television every day. So this is going to fail. And people like Samir Jaja and the Lebanese forces, these are the same people who carried out massacres in the 1980s on behalf of the Israeli regime and with the Israeli regime. They slaughtered 4,000 Palestinians in the Sabra Shatila camp. No one is going to join them, and no one will expect them to be people who carry out genocide in the past. No one is going to expect them to be with Hezbollah today, and no one is going to join them against Hezbollah, because if they do, as I said, their credibility and reputation will be destroyed. So I don't think there's going to be any serious move. I mean, Western embassies are working on it. Their people are working on it. They're working with the Lebanese forces and others to try to do something, but it's not going to work.
And recently we had the foreign minister of Iran going to Saudi Arabia talking with them. Do we know how the Iranian government, the Pezeshkian administration is trying to manage the situation, considering the Arab states and the way that they can be used to attack Iran, Israeli attack on Iran? What do we know from that? Are they going to collaborate with Israel? Do they have any sort of response, rigid response to Iran, that they're not going to be there supporting Israel? What do we know from these meetings?
Again, I think it's going to be very difficult for anyone to cooperate with the Israeli regime, because it only undermines their legitimacy in the eyes of the public. The public across the region is already very unhappy with those governments that are not actively supporting the Palestinians and the Lebanese, whether it's Saudi Arabia or Jordan or the Emirates or Egypt or Turkey. It doesn't matter. Any government that's not supporting the cause is frowned upon. So if any of these governments actually help the Americans or the Israelis, for that matter, in striking Iran, under these circumstances where genocide is being carried out and genocidal attacks are being carried out in Lebanon as well, alongside the genocide in Gaza, it's only going to make their situation, the situation for these governments, more difficult to manage. And, you know, as we discussed, I think, before, often things seem quiet and calm, but a small spark could lead to a forest fire. We saw that when the young man in Tunisia burned himself alive for local grievance. It had ramifications across the region. That's one issue. The second is that the Iranians have already warned these countries that if their airspace is used or if their territory is used in any way or form against Iran, they will be seen as hostile. And these countries, all of them, are extremely vulnerable. None of them are strong countries. All of them are very vulnerable. If Iran just, let's say, fired a few missiles at the Emirates, the country would probably collapse. Saudi Arabia could not win a war against Ansarullah years ago. It's completely vulnerable. So think that they all got the message, and they will try very hard not to be a source of tension. But at the end of the day, if the Americans do, and here I'm speaking about the Americans, if the Americans do enter the fight, these none of these regimes can escape the fact that American bases are, the Americans are hosted in their countries. And the Iranians, you know, when it becomes an existential threat, then, you know, Iran will not hold back. And all of these countries, all of these family dictatorships, they're extremely vulnerable because they're not popular. It doesn't matter if it's the Emirates or if it's anyone else in the Persian Gulf region. They're not popular. So if they get hit, the global economy will collapse, but so will these regimes. So I find it very difficult to imagine them allowing the Israelis to use their territory, except for maybe Jordan, because it is so compromised and so weak and so dependent on the United States, the king, for it to maintain power. And I'm sure that they are begging the Americans not to enter any conflict with Iran because of the consequences it would have for them.
Yeah. How about Egypt? You didn't mention Egypt. And we know that Israelis are not, they're not going to give the Philadelphia corridor, which is so important for Gazans. And it seems that the Egyptian government is trying to do something, but they're not capable of, because of the United States, the pressure that they're putting on the on Egypt and the leverage they're having because of their economic problems, that we know what's going on in Egypt. How do you find their role in Gaza right now, and how they can do better, in your opinion?
Well, the Egyptian government is very dependent on handouts from the Emirates and Saudi Arabia. I don't think that is the real reason why they don't become more involved. If the Egyptian was to take a real stand, they would gain popularity among their own people, and people would be a part of this because the Egyptian people support the Palestinian people. They support the resistance in Lebanon. So if the Egyptian government actually took a stance to protect its own sovereignty and to stop genocide, then I think that things would change in Egypt. But since, you know, these regimes have from the very beginning been completely dependent or largely dependent on the outside, they were never built to be founded upon the trust of their own people, whether it's Jordan or Egypt or the Emirates. And therefore, that mentality is not something that can easily be changed, if it can be changed at all. So even though it would be smart for the Egyptians to make the right choice, the Egyptian government, they will probably not do that. But Iran is trying to push all the countries in the regions to take even the smallest steps. Any step against the Israeli regime now, any move against the Israeli regime, whether it be economic or political or military, is good for the region. It makes things more costly for Netanyahu and those people around him in Tel Aviv. So the Iranians are going to do their best to, you know, to create better coordination or cooperation with Egypt, with the Saudis, with Turkey. Some will be more successful, some less successful. But it is a part of the broader conflict. Politics, you know, politics matters. It's not just about the military. Just like I've said before to people who support the resistance and who feel helpless, they feel that they cannot do anything, I say, I always tell them that even the small things that you do, if you tweet something, if you refrain from purchasing something from a country that supports Israel, all of these small things that we all do collectively matter. It doesn't, someone may have an audience of 10 million, someone may have an audience of two. It doesn't matter. They, you know, each person does plays their own role. And so each part of this equation is significant. Politics is important, just as propaganda and Western propaganda and countering that propaganda is important, and so is battling the regime on the battlefields of southern Lebanon. All of these are important together.
Yeah, with the situation that we're having with UNIFIL in Lebanon recently, they were talking about that Israelis are attacking UNIFIL. And Netanyahu came out and sent a video, he sent a video message talking about that. We are not attacking you. We are asking you to get out of Lebanon. And yesterday we learned that again they're attacking UNIFIL. And in your opinion, what's the end game on the part of Israelis? Because as we know, whenever they're attacking civilians, they're talking about these or Hezbollah sites, strongholds, and these are related to Hezbollah, a lot of weapons there, we are destroying them. And when it comes to UNIFIL, they cannot argue that. And this is the problem with the rhetoric in the West. And do you think this is a country which is based on a decision made at the UN? The UN decided to give them some sort of right to exist. And right now they're attacking UN. And how we can understand this?
Well, you know that UNIFIL and the people who work for it, there are some very good people there. And there are some people who are definitely working for the Israelis and the Americans and Western intelligence. And on the whole, UNIFIL has done a lot of intelligent people within UNIFIL have done a lot of intelligence gathering for the Israeli regime, or they've attempted to do so. So UNIFIL has traditionally been more beneficial to the Israelis than to the Lebanese. And they're based inside Lebanon, even though they're monitoring the border. It's not as if they're based inside Palestine. They're all inside Lebanon. They're occupying Lebanese territory. They're not occupying anything inside Palestine. But the very fact that the Israeli regime won't tolerate this body, which is, as you pointed out, controlled, belongs to the UN, which is dominated by the West, shows how, you know, how irrational and how aggressive and how demanding this regime is. And it shows how little resistance there is to the Israeli regime in the West. Because some of these UNIFIL soldiers are Europeans, but they're still being targeted or harassed by the regime, and nothing really seriously happens. So the UN, which is a deeply compromised organization, I think ultimately it won't exist for much longer, I think, or it will just fade away gradually. It's sort of like the League of Nations after the First World War. I think regional bodies, as well as bodies like BRICS, are going to become increasingly more important, not just for economic reasons, but I think many of them will gradually broaden their scope of activities to include culture and politics and economics and gradually, I think you're going to see many bodies in these regional and global organizations that parallel the bodies inside the UN. That's quite possible, of course, as long as we get there. If there's no global economic collapse that will lead to a very different world from what we're living in today. But it just shows that this regime can literally get away with anything. True, the French president was unhappy, some European politicians and leaders are unhappy, but we shouldn't put in any hope in anything that comes out of the Western political establishment. These flickers of light that we see now and then, they're just flickers of light that will go away. A lot of them are basically to appease their own populations, which are very angry with the elites in the West. But then we should not expect them to do anything serious about it. But it does hurt the regime. As I said, everything counts, and we have to, you know, build upon this to create greater momentum against the regime politically, but also in the eyes of the global public.
And with the situation right now in Syria, and we know that Russia is bombing two cities, Idlib and Aleppo, which are these Wahhabis are supported by the United States. And what's going on, in your opinion, in that region? We have Turkey together with Russia. These people are, it's so complicated when you look at the situation there. And it seems a mess, but at the end of the day, we know how important Syria is for the access of resistance, and for what they're doing in Lebanon, and how Syria is important to give support to Lebanon. What's going on in terms of the government in Syria and the actions of Russia together with Turkey?
Well, imagine if there wasn't a dirty war in Syria during the previous decade. Syria today would have been much stronger, and the Israeli regime would have been in a very tough situation. But right now, Syria can only facilitate. It can help Hezbollah, it can help the resistance in the West Bank, but it's you know, barely able to sustain itself and its people. Part of the country is occupied by the Americans and their proxies. Part of it's occupied by Turkey and its proxies. And part of it, of course, is occupied by the Israeli regime, the Syrian Golan. So I think it's clear for everyone who is rational that the dirty war in Syria was a result of a Western-led conspiracy. And the West and its allies are the people who caused the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Syrians. And today the country is deep, very, you know, there are heavy sanctions that keep the people poor. They're doing this basically because of Israel. They occupy the country because of Israel. They keep the country weak because of Israel. In Idlib, in the province of Idlib, these Takfiri forces, these extremists, these old Al-Qaeda, because Hayat Tahrir al-Sham was Al-Qaeda. And then it split away, but it split away with the support of Al-Qaeda. And in fact, they split away from Al-Qaeda in the presence of senior Al-Qaeda, people who are also saying, yes, yes, they are no longer with us, which obviously means that Al-Qaeda and Hayat Tahrir, what is now called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, that they're still allies, they're still the same. But for practical purposes, they decided to split so that Hayat Tahrir al-Sham could be more openly supported by NATO. Even though it was supported, we have to remember Jake Sullivan's email. We always have to keep that in mind. His email from February the 12th, 2012, a decade after 9/11, he said, "In Syria, Al Qaeda is on our side." In an email to Hillary Clinton, who was the Secretary of State back then. So Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, we know where the funding comes from. We know where the logistical support comes from. It comes from Turkey, and we know where the funding comes from. If Turkey wants, or if countries, oil and gas rich countries, certain wealthy countries in the Persian Gulf, if they want to support the people of Lebanon and Gaza, the best thing they can do right now is pull back, allow Syria to regain its sovereignty so that it could focus on supporting the resistance and strengthening its positions alongside the Golan and to support the West Bank, if they really want to help. But we are seeing the exact opposite. We're seeing a mobilization of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham and other forces in Idlib against the Syrian government. This has been going on for a while. And then we just recently saw that the airstrikes were being carried out on their positions by the Russians and the Syrians. But Idlib is very complicated. And there are many groups, and those groups are supported by different people and different governments. And you may be surprised, but some governments are supporting different parts of certain governments are supporting different groups against one another. It's a big mess. And one reason why they are unsuccessful against the Syrian government is that they're often busy killing each other. In any case, Idlib will continue to be a problem for Syria. It will impede Syria from being more supportive of the resistance, of being able to do more for the resistance. But Syria, as we speak, is unlike any of these countries in the region. Regardless, I'm not saying it's a utopia. I'm not saying the government is a great government. There are many problems in Syria. I've been to Syria many times, but two things. One is that the people in Syria that I've met in different cities over the years, they definitely prefer this government to those groups in Idlib and the others that the Americans and foreign powers are supporting. That is without a doubt. That throughout the previous decade was something that I constantly saw among students at universities that I went to, whether in Homs or in Damascus or elsewhere. But in general, I think that the Syrian government has done more to support the Palestinian people and the resistance in Lebanon than any of these countries that tried to bring it down. The countries that tried to bring down Syria, whether Turkey, whether countries in the Persian Gulf, whether Jordan, none of them are playing the role that Syria is playing today. So certain people can curse Syria all they want, but if they are serious, they should start pushing their own governments to make a move. Otherwise, when we look at what happened in the previous decade and what these governments are doing today, I think it's clear as day what Syria was all about. And those who continue to try to put the focus on Syria, I think either they are secretly trying to support the West and Israel, and many are, or that they are simply too sectarian or naive to be able to see reality.
Just before wrapping up this session, we are going to have a BRICS summit in Kazan in Russia. And right now in Iran, what is the perception of the importance of BRICS and how they can change the relationship between Iran and BRICS countries?
This is going to be a very, very important meeting, and it should be the top news story across the world, alongside the genocide and the ongoing genocidal attacks in Lebanon. But it isn't, and I think that there's a reason why it isn't, because the Western media, being a part of the state apparatus, or being aligned to the state apparatus, does not want people to see it that way. BRICS is going to bring great change. It's not going to happen overnight. It's not as if the day after the summit in Kazan, we're going to have new mechanisms for trade and everything is going to move smoothly and U.S. sanctions and European sanctions are going to be nullified. But it is a turning point, and it is going to intensify the pace of change. And it will affect more than just BRIC states. It will affect the world. This is a process that we're seeing where these countries want greater financial independence from the West. They want their currencies or their trade to be protected from the West. Therefore, they want to decrease the importance of the US dollar. The very fact that Trump made the statements that he did a few days ago about 100% tariffs on any country that refrains from using the US dollar as the reserve currency shows, I think it shows how important this is. And it also shows how desperate the West is, because this is such an actual work. I think Donald Trump probably knows this himself, but it's good for the audience and people applaud and it makes America look strong. But this is a process and powerful countries are a part of this. The most powerful countries in the world are a part of this. Some of them may be more dedicated, some less so, but they're still all a part of this broader process. And the declining powers in the West, they're against it. So obviously it's not there. The West is not going to be able to stop this. But I also think it's more than just financial. I think it's also going to have impact on the internet. I think it's going to, right now, we are all hostages of big tech in the United States. You could lose your YouTube channel whenever they decide to remove you. They can take years ago, they took my Instagram account and my Facebook accounts, my two accounts. But Twitter can remove my account right now if it wants to. They may actually be limiting my ability to speak to the public through X without me knowing, shadow banning or whatever else it is they do. These are all issues that BRICS countries will be dealing with increasingly in future. They will be seeking independence from big tech. They will seek alternatives to big tech. You will probably see in future other, things similar to Twitter or YouTube or Instagram, which have an international audience that no longer belong to the United States or any Western power. And the list goes on. Media, until recently, the West dominated the media. Mainstream media or legacy media has always been very powerful. That is decreasing because the global majority or the global South has been growing more powerful, and you have more regional and local media outlets, and you have social media. But also they will be expecting, these countries will be expecting a more balanced media environment in the world, that they will be cooperating more in future. So many things are going to change. They won't happen overnight, but I think that this summit will bring new energy to this process. And what's happening in Gaza and what's happening in Lebanon will only increase the pace of change, because no one accepts what the West is doing.
Yeah.
And also the war in Ukraine and the end game, which is now being played out. We are nearing the end of the war, and it's going to be a failure for the West. And that failure, I think, will also have implications that will be linked to what BRICS does in future.
I think what you've mentioned is so important, because the war in Ukraine was so crucial in the view of Russians and how they cannot trust the West, the collective West. And right now, the conflict in the Middle East is giving some sort of message to Iran that they cannot trust them, they cannot negotiate with them. And as a result, these two outcomes can bring Russia and Iran together. Are we going to see the same kind of relationship that we are witnessing between Russia and China happening between Iran and Russia?
Well, the relationship between Iran and Russia has evolved dramatically over the past, ever since the war in Ukraine began. And the relationship actually improved a lot after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Iran had huge problems with the Soviet Union, especially over Afghanistan. But after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the relationship changed. But Russia was always looking to the West, and it never really focused on building a very strong relationship with Iran, especially since Iran was sanctioned or increasingly being sanctioned. But ever since the war in Ukraine began, things changed dramatically. And I think the the unexpected meeting between President Pezeshkian and President Putin in Turkmenistan, I think it was a sign of that, how the relationship has evolved. So I think that Iran and Russia will probably move closer to each other, especially because, basically because of the stupidity of the West. The West is creating all, the West has created BRICS. The West has created the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. It is through their actions that these new relationships are being brought about. The bilateral relationship and the decision by Iran and Russia to have a new type of partnership, which will be declared in a couple of weeks, probably after BRICS. All of these are linked to Western behavior. Russian trade routes have shifted away from Europe, and now they're going to be moving in our direction. Their gas hub will go through Iran. That didn't have to happen. If the West had behaved more reasonably, they would have still been central to global trade. So in my opinion, the reason why BRICS is becoming so important is because of Western behavior. And the Western behavior has changed the relationship between Iran and Russia, and will continue to do so in the foreseeable future. And once a relationship has been, you know, set in stone, once the Russians see the benefits of trading with Iran and using the Persian Gulf and the Indian Ocean for trade and vice versa, then it's going to be much more difficult in future to separate these different countries that have had their relationships evolve in such a way.
Yeah. And recently, the Biden administration is putting out statements talking about that if Iran wants to harm Donald Trump,
I knew you were going to ask that.
It's unbelievable. This political game, which is a domestic political game, but do you think, does it have anything to do with the Trump administration? If Trump wins, are they trying to prepare him or prepare his administration to make a big fight in the Middle East? Which is so, if you remember, in the first term of Donald Trump, he wasn't eager, he wasn't that willing to go to war with Iran, with that differences he had with Bolton. And Bolton was totally in line. He really wanted to attack Iran. But right now, how do you find this rhetoric? Is that related to what they're planning in the aftermath of the Trump presidency in the United States, if he wins?
That's a very good question, and I don't have the answer. I think there are probably some people that you could bring on your show who would be able to provide better detail about what's going on in the United States. I would imagine that, you know, obviously the assassinations, at least the first attempt, was something that was a part of the state and the state apparatus. The problems with, you know, the story, there's so many problems that it's just impossible to imagine that people in power didn't know that this first assassination attempt was going to take place. I just don't believe it. Such a thing could never happen in Iran, with some shooter just, you know, having that such a great shot at an Iranian leader. It just wouldn't happen. That is just too simple, and it's not possible. It would have been stopped if they were serious. The other two I can't comment on, but I would imagine that Trump knows that this is not, it has nothing to do with Iran, and the reason why he's making these statements is he's trying to get sympathy and support from people who will be voting in the next 3 weeks. And I would imagine that Biden, in order to prevent that from happening, or the Biden team and the Harris team, that they are simply repeating it to show that, so that Trump doesn't take advantage of this claim. and that they're saying, we're, you know, they want to show themselves as being strong. Otherwise, I don't think anyone really, I think most Americans, from what I've seen online, they knew that the first, they believe that the first assassination attempt was a deep state act, or at least a part of the deep state. And the second and third, again, I don't, since nothing really happened, I don't know much about it, and I can't comment about it. I don't think people, that many people take it that seriously. It's hard for me to imagine that Trump is that stupid. I mean, I believe that Trump is not a stupid person. I think he is intelligent. He says many strange things, but I don't think he's stupid. I think he's a sinister person, just like I think Harris and Biden are sinister people. What Harris and Biden have done in Gaza and in Lebanon, it's as evil as it gets. But I don't think that Trump is dumb enough, stupid enough to believe that the Iranians were behind this. The Iranians are obviously a good scapegoat. He uses it to his advantage. Biden and Harris want to use it to their advantage. But at the end of the day, I think it's very clear that the assassination was an indigenous attempt to get rid of Trump. And the second two were probably, may have been personal, may have been a part of the same deep state elements within the deep state. I have no idea, but I don't think anyone serious in the United States believes that this has anything to do with Iran.
Thank you so much, Professor, for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.
Thank you very much for having me.